Alex, I appreciate you doing this, my friend.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Actually,
Pleasure.
I
Yeah.
felt after you told me what you do for a living, I felt like I should be interviewing you.
No.
I'm sure it's a lot more interesting than what I do for a living.
I don't know. Your book's pretty kick-ass, man. You did an incredible job. So, where are you calling me from? Judging from the background, San Fran, the Bay Area?
Yeah, that's very helpfully locating me for people. Yeah, I'm in San Francisco
Best food
in the
from there.
fog.
When you're traveling, when you're all over the world, what's one food you can't wait to get home from? Like, I need to get back to San Fran to eat what?
I wouldn't say necessarily getting back to San Francisco, but I think what I would always miss most just from the US in general, I used to live in New York, is bagels. Bagel culture does not really exist outside the US.
Montreal, a little bit in Montreal, but that's it.
Yeah, but well, I haven't been to Montreal, but it can't be the same.
Have you ever seen someone reading one of your books in public yet?
Trying to think. I have not actually, and it's really sad to think actually, but I did run into someone who'd read my book in a really unexpected place once, which is maybe just as good. I'm a rock climber, and I was in Yosemite several months ago, and I was at the base of a climb waiting to start, and I heard a couple of guys speaking Portuguese, so I started speaking to them in Portuguese, and they asked, how I learned Portuguese, and I started talking about how I'd lived in Brazil and used to report on billionaires, which was I used to that was my first book, Brazilianaires, was about reporting on billionaires in Brazil, and one of them's like, Alex.
Wow.
And he'd read the book, which is, yeah, not a place I would expect to find that. So yeah, I guess that's almost as good.
Hell yeah, that's really cool. Okay, I know you came to school in the Big Apple. You were born here also. Where were you born?
Harlem. My
Okay.
dad's a doctor, and he did his residency up at St. Luke's.
And when did you move out to New Mexico?
When I was five, yeah.
Growing up in New Mexico, give it to me. Because I grew up in New York my whole life. What was your childhood growing up in New Mexico?
It's a place that I've come to appreciate as an adult, but as a teenager, I just wanted to get out of there. I feel like this is a really typical suburban American experience, but what I remember from being a teenager there was, you're in your car, all you can do is drive around, but we'd end up in Walmart parking lots at night, just wishing we could, go to someplace like New York or LA, somewhere interesting.
And Sarah Lawrence, is that why you came up back to New York for college?
Yeah, went to Sarah Lawrence College,
Okay.
and which was a great experience, and tried to get into the city as much as I could, and lived there for a few years after I graduated.
Where'd you live in the city?
A few different places. Initially in Spanish Harlem,
Okay.
because my girlfriend at the time was still going to Sarah Lawrence, so she could kind of it was a quick train ride,
Okay.
and then in Brooklyn in a few different neighborhoods, Park Slope, Fort Greene.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And was it always author or bus for you, journalist and or bus? Was that it for you?
I knew from the time I was like 9 years old that I wanted to be a writer.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
But I didn't know that it would be in journalism. I studied creative writing at Sarah Lawrence, and I was a college poet. So I thought I would be a poet, but eventually, I guess, I just started reading more widely and started reading the work of journalists like John Lee Anderson, who I came to know later, journalists who were spending a lot of time in Latin America, and I thought, this could be a way to combine my two interests. I wanted to live in Latin America, I wanted to travel, and I wanted to write, so it seemed like a way to combine those two things. And then I discovered as I started to do it that I really loved it. I loved being a journalist and going to, places that you wouldn't ordinarily go to and talk to people who, you just never meet otherwise, as a, middle class person in the US.
Do you remember your first piece of journalism or writing? You could have been 10 years old or 2 weeks ago. They got any press? The people are like, oh crap, I wrote that and people are actually reading it.
I know this because my parents have it like framed on their wall, but when I was, I think, 9 years old, I won a writing competition for elementary schoolers, and it was a little essay about the beautiful bosque, the forest that my parents' home is in Albuquerque, right next to the Rio Grande.
When you leave college, do you go to a newspaper or you go right down to Bogota?
I spent a bit of time working at a publishing house in New York, and
Okay.
then I quit because I wanted to write.
Wow.
And I had a little bit of money my grandparents had given me when I graduated, so I quit my job and decided to backpack around South America.
That's sick.
And I kind of had in the back of my head that I was going to stay in the place that I liked best.
Okay.
And so in each kind of capital city that I went through, I reached out to journalists, the kind of established foreign correspondents, and asked if they'd, be willing to get a coffee or a beer. And ask them about it,
Wow.
and people were generally willing to do it. I think everyone remembers when they were, a kid fresh out of college, and were trying to figure things out. So I found that, generally people were very responsive to that, and it kind of demystified it for me a bit as I went, to realize like these are, they're just ordinary people like anyone else. Like it's nothing too, it feels crazy from afar, but then you realize, well, you can just go and do it. But I got to Bogota and I just really liked the city. The people were incredibly warm and welcoming, and it was just a fascinating place. This Colombia, it's at the same time that the people are incredibly warm and welcoming, it has this contradictory history, of the most terrible violence. So it was a really, it was a really rich place to try and start to be a journalist. And Venezuela was nearby, which was also a crazy story. So I just started pitching stories, and eventually editors started accepting them, and I learned how to do it by doing it, basically. And then some of these, proper journalists I'd met along the way gave me tips here and there.
And then when was the move to Brazil?
So I spent a couple of years in Bogota, and I started freelancing for Bloomberg when I was in Bogota. And I spoke a little bit of Portuguese from having traveled in Brazil a bit. And just picked up a bit because I knew Spanish already. So a job came up in Sao Paulo with Bloomberg, and they asked me if I was interested. So I went.
That was actually my next question, English and Spanish. How'd you learn Portuguese? Because my wife's from the Philippines, so I'm learning Tagalog. So I'm curious how you
Okay.
learn the
Oh
language.
wow. My dad is Bolivian. He was born the year that his parents immigrated to the US from Bolivia. He speaks English better than Spanish, but I would hear words and stuff growing up. But I studied Spanish, studied Latin American literature and Spanish in college. So I had a base, and then I really I did a year abroad in Spain, and then living in Colombia really cemented it. And Portuguese, it's but you know Spanish, I made a study of it. I taking Latin American literature classes, and but Portuguese, I learned just by speaking it and reading books. Knowing Spanish, it wasn't hard to pick up a book and basically understand what was going on. And speaking to people, once you kind of know, the pronunciation's a bit different. A lot of the words are the same. So it was actually, it wasn't too hard to pick up. Although I remember in the beginning, I would go to a bar and hang out with a bunch of Brazilians, and after an hour, I would just be mentally exhausted and I just wouldn't be able to even listen or attempt to speak anymore. Like I would just be tapped out. But yeah, I just picked it up. I never really studied it.
And what's that food down there? When I was in Brazil, we had that. It starts with an F. It's the stew with the orange and the
Oh,
rice.
feijoada.
Oh, yes. When I was in Rio, we had that. Oh my God, it was incredible. You miss that?
Yeah, feijoada is delicious. Yeah, I was just down there in November actually, and I had to get the feijoada. Feijoada is great. Yeah. And it's the story of the feijoada is it originated as the dish that the slaves would make. It was sort of all the discarded parts of the pig in a big pot of beans. But it's delicious because all the all the pig ear and whatnot just flavors the stew. Yeah, Brazilian food, I don't know, I got a little tired of it. In the I don't know, it's a lot of rice and beans. And reporting in the Amazon in particular, in the part there is an Amazonian cuisine that's really incredible. More in the north of the Amazon, they have these herbs like jambu, which is like if you've ever had Sichuan numbing peppers, it's a similar kind of thing where it numbs your tongue and has a kind of sharp, bitter flavor. But in the part of the Amazon where I spend a lot of time, they don't have as much of a food culture. So it's just a lot of rice and beans and beef. Although I did, when I was reporting on this tribe for my book, and I'm sure you'll get to that, but I got a chance to eat some interesting things like turtle, which I found was very similar to duck, actually, and monkey brain, which was surprising. I mean, it was very good. If you like offal, if you like liver and that kind of thing, it's very rich. But I was only able to eat like half the brain before I had to say that's as much as I can take. It's very intense.
So let's talk about the book. You come out with the bomb book, Brazilian Heirs, that won awards and stuff. Why do we have to wait so long for this book when we sold God's Eye, Diamonds, Murder, and A Clash of Worlds in the Amazon? Why do we have to wait so long for this book, Alex? Tell me. You have a lot of fans. People are like, all
Well,
right, let's get your
my
next book out.
yeah, I started working on this in I actually I already I'd read about this tribe. I guess I should say a little I should
Yeah,
give the sort of
describe the book
capsule,
better than I
the
can.
elevator pitch. So the book is about a tribe in the Amazon, the Cinta Larga, who had no contact with the Western world until the 1960s and came to run an illegal diamond mine in the 2000s. So I'd heard about this tribe in 2016, around the time I published my first book, Brazilian Heirs. I'd heard about it and I wanted to do a story, but it took a while to sort of get an assignment. But basically, well, my publisher asked the same question that you did. I blew past three deadlines. But basically, when I wrote a proposal, and I had no idea how long it was going to take to write this, but my publisher said they'd give me a year and a half, and it's like, okay, I have no idea, but we'll see. But it was just a book that it just required so much reporting. It's a book where, I should explain a little more about it.
Yeah, because you completely undersold it, like no contact with the world until the 60s, and all of a sudden they're thrown thrust into this world of selling wood and diamonds. It's like a diamond mafia in the middle of the Amazon. There's murder involved. You undersold it because this book is sick, bro.
Well, thank you. So yeah, I mean, so when I heard about this story, I couldn't believe it's, this tribe that had, until the 1960s, had no contact with the Western world. That means, they had no concept of money. They had no concept of what is a government, what are laws. And they were thrust into the Western world in the most brutal way possible when the first highway was built through their lands. And then they end up enmeshed in one of the darkest corners of capitalism, having to figure out how markets work and money works through, the illegal diamond trade, basically. So to me, it seemed like a chance to tell a story about, what so many indigenous groups have been through across the Americas, colonialism, capitalism, a 500-year history, but the one that had been compressed into a single lifetime. The first time I went, I spoke to people from this tribe who were kids when the first settlers showed up in the 1960s. And, this happened in living memory. And they told me about, they told me, on the one hand, they're really sad stories, stories about losing their entire families to disease because they had no genetic resistance, to all the things that, people in the West are very used to, flu, for example, which, the first time it spread to one of their villages, it spread from village to village and just killed dozens and ultimately hundreds. So really sad stories, but then also really, stories that are quite funny and that they would laugh to think about looking back about the first time. So for example, the protagonist of my book is a guy named Piu. And he told me about the first time that he tasted salty food because they have no source of artificial salt. And the first time he tasted salty food, and I should add that, you asked me about Brazilian food. It is very salty, even by, Western standards. So the first time he tasted it, it felt like it was burning his mouth. He told me about the first time he encountered money and he had, he did not understand what it was. The first time he encountered it, it was a government agent in the rainforest who's paying him to do work. But how do you explain to someone who's never seen a market what money is? So he tried tearing it up. He asked this other kid from the tribe, what is this stuff? And the kid said, I don't know, but it looks important. I think maybe we should hold on to it. just crazy stories and about trying to understand, like being dropped into an alien world, basically. So what I wanted to do with this was kind of invert the traditional narrative of the Amazon, because the usual story is, and these are often great books, like The Lost City of Z, great book.
Yeah.
And David Grant is a writer who I really admire.
Yeah, he's coming on soon, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, well, he's a fantastic writer and someone who, as a writer, I really, look up to. But, the standard narrative of the Amazon is one where there's a white explorer, who's going to these crazy places and meeting, indigenous people. And I'm putting all these things in quotations, primitive savages. Mm-hmm. But as I'm talking to people from this tribe, the Cinta Larga, I'm realizing that this experience of this encounter was so much more bizarre for them, right? Because they were going from a world where they had no idea that any of this existed. These white explorers already kind of knew, right?
Yeah.
quote unquote savages. So for me, it was really important to tell this story from the perspective of the people in the tribe. And to do that, I had to do hundreds of hours of interviews. And so, I ended up doing 10 separate extended reporting trips. Usually I would go for 3 weeks at a time. I was often sleeping in their main village.
Wow.
I would sleep in there in the government clinic, which surreally had air conditioning.
What?
You don't expect these things, but it is a sort of a it, just a sign of how much this place has changed. A generation ago, there was nothing but rainforest here. And now there's electricity, there's air conditioning, there's internet, there's WhatsApp, there's Facebook. So it was a book that I could only do. And of course, you can't do these interviews over the phone,
No.
right? Even though they have WhatsApp. I
Yeah.
mean, and it was a matter of, I just had to spend a lot of time hanging out. You also, you can't set up the interview on a Google Calendar invite. I would just have to go and hang out and wait for the right people to be around. And at the same time, I spent, there was a whole other part of this was, I have all these interviews, but, I need to find like whatever documentary evidence I can that's going to kind of, buttress their stories with sort of, with cold hard evidence,
Yeah.
to the extent possible. So I spent the whole pandemic on lockdown in London, where I was living at the time, reading through government documents and old press stories and court files to kind of fill in the other part of this story. But that's why it took me so long. And in the end, it took me the whole process of reporting and writing it took 6 years or so. And the writing was also, it was a big challenge because it was much more so than with my first book. I was reconstructing, events from, 30 years ago where, I've interviewed maybe 10 people about the same event and not everything they says lines up.
Yeah.
They say not everything they say lines up. And I'm combining their interviews and documents, and yeah, it was a challenge that I had never faced as a writer before. So I also had to learn how to do this kind of narrative nonfiction as I went.
Speaking of challenges, how did you initially even set up the thing? You heard about the story. How I know they have WhatsApp. How'd you even set up, like, hey, this white dude's coming down here. He wants to interview you guys. How'd that whole process happen?
Right. So I saw this story in the Brazilian press about a Belgian couple who had been caught at the airport with diamonds in all of their orifices. And then deep low down in the story was a little line, the diamonds are thought to have come from this illegal mine in the Amazon and mentioned this tribe. So I started reading up on the tribe and I found a government official who worked with the tribe.
Okay.
And he sort of his role was to kind of represent their interests before the government. So I reached out to him, and an amazing guy. His name is Reginaldo Trindade, a really self-sacrificing guy who'd won a lot of credit with them, because to the extent they're known in Brazil, it's as diamond barons.
Wow.
They became In the 2000s, when this diamond mine erupted, they became known in Brazil. And this is this it kind of recalls another David Grann story, Killers of the Flower Moon. But they became famous in Brazil as the Diamond Chiefs, was how one newspaper put it. But an elite within the tribe who came to run this diamond mine They started spending vast amounts of money on imported cars. One of them would tell people that his dream was to own a different car for every day of the week,
Come on.
and he achieved it. Another one, who's an important character in my book, Uita, he's the guy who probably got richest of any of them during this time. He had Hilux, Toyota Hiluxes. He had, gold jewelry. He owned a mansion in one of the nearby towns. He bought a ranch and filled it with more than 200 cattle. And even white people, settlers who lived in the nearby towns near the indigenous area, would call him Doctor, which is a Latin American term of respect. Literally, it means doctor, but it's just like saying sir. To the extent they were known in Brazil, it was sort of as outlaws. And most notoriously, in 2004, some of their warriors killed 29 prospectors who refused to leave their lands. So they had a really bad reputation, to say the least. And this government official tried to argue to them, you guys have this bad reputation. You should let this international journalist in, so that he can tell you guys about the problems you have, because they'd been through a whole boom and bust with the mine, and it was only ever an elite within the tribe who got rich, and the rest of them have always been poor. So he prevailed upon them to let me in and, tell this larger story, tell the whole story, the story of contact and all the terrible things they went through. So he opened the door on that first trip, and then I started to make my own friendships and relationships with them.
That's so crazy because, like you said, it's all in within less than 100 years. So, in the 60s, the white man, the Westerner, he comes there. What was their life like before that? Before they made initial contact, just living in the Amazon, doing their thing with, like you said, lawless, but not crimes, just living their life, right?
Right. So, and this is a really important part of the book, is, we're following Piu, who's the protagonist. He's a kid when settlers show up. So we experience the world before contact through his eyes, right? The eyes of a kid. So we're experiencing it through the lens of of nostalgia, right? So he's remembering the world of his father. And his father was a great hunter. And he was also a great warrior. Now, when you look at this past through, this kind of nostalgic child's view, it's very romantic. It was a life of hunting, hunt and a great hunter. He had to be a master of, every aspect of archery and knowing which herbs to use. He also had to be a great war, and they were very proud of their warrior history. And they would tell stories about really courageous battles where they would sneak into an enemy's longhouse in the middle of the night, and they would all, get set up by their enemies' hammocks, ready to start clubbing them to death, when someone gave the signal. It's like if you draw an analogy to it almost sounds like Braveheart, this world of warriors and great hunters. At the same time, there were people who recognized like it was kind of a brutal existence. It was very violent. They would go to war with neighboring tribes. There was no friendship with neighboring tribes. There was no trade. There was no diplomacy. And even within the tribe, the men were very, there was an honor culture. It's sort of like the, old European culture of dueling. If you said something nasty to someone's face, he was liable to kill you. And women, this is, this is always the great qualifier to any kind of sunny story of the past. Women had it worst. They were often just seen as basically possessions. And in battles with enemy tribes, a woman might be captured and then she would just, she'd be kidnapped and made into a wife and she'd be integrated into the tribe. But, it sort of gives you a sense of how women were seen at the time. So it was, it was a time where, there were, I don't want to say there were ups and downs, but I will say that for all of the, for all of the terrible violence, it was a time when they saw themselves and felt themselves to be the protagonists of their own history. They were the masters of their world and their environment, which made it all the more shocking when these outsiders start coming in and, with representatives of this much more powerful society that comes to, try to dominate them.
I always feel they get such a bad rap. They put in our whole history of cars and cell phones into like 20 years. Like, because most of the whole tribe got eliminated with diseases and stuff. Like, the numbers are pretty staggering when you really put them out there, down to like under 400, I think it was. And then all of a sudden, you're giving them cell phones, cars, soda. You're giving them all stuff that we are slowly introduced to. Hey, bro, here's everything. Like, of course, they're going to be overwhelmed. And they get such a bad rap for that, don't they?
Absolutely. And this was, part of this story, a big part of this story is the government's, the kind of the West's role in this. And when, after the first highway was built, this Brazilian government agency used to be called the Indian Protection Service, now it's called FUNAI, was tasked with contacting and quote unquote pacifying them. And it was a really contradictory sort of enterprise because the Indian Protection Service, from its founding, on the one hand, it was this deeply idealistic endeavor. Let's, the indigenous people are human beings just like anybody else. They deserve to be protected. At a time when a lot of settlers saw indigenous people basically as wild animals who should be killed, so that the land could be made productive. So on the one hand, it was, this really idealistic desire to protect the Indians, as the name suggests, the Indian Protection Service. At the same time, it was part of a strategy to assimilate the indigenous people. We're going to bring them into Western society, into Brazilian society. We're going to turn them into white people, into economically productive citizens. So from the start, what the strategy was, we're going to lure them to so-called attraction posts, which is what they called the government camps,
Oh my God.
with gifts of metal tools. Because, for indigenous people, they had no steel. And so, a steel knife, a steel axe is incredibly useful. And, it's really revolutionary to a lot of the, daily tasks and to warfare. So they lure them with metal tools. And once they've lured them in and, shown them we're here, we're here to be your friends, to welcome you into this new world, and to protect you from the settlers who want to kill you. Then they start, tapering, weaning them, off of these gifts, basically. So, instead of giving them the gifts, they start to say, well, actually, you have to work for these things. So they start putting the indigenous people to work in the attraction posts, working in the fields. And the idea is we're going to turn them into agricultural workers. But, the big problem is that they never really gave the Cinta Larga or any other indigenous group a sustainable way to actually acquire the things that they came to want, that they were taught to want and need. So Pio would always complain that in the 1980s, and he's by this time Pew is an adult, he's becoming a leader of his people. In the 1980s, the Cinta Larga discovered this cache of mahogany trunks that had been cut down, 800 mahogany trunks that had been cut down by a rancher who'd invaded their lands. And they don't know what this is all about. I mean, they just report it to, the Indian agents. But one of the Indian agents tells them, "This here is worth a lot of money. You guys just won the lottery. Don't let it rot. Don't let it go to waste. Sell this stuff." And that is the start of when the Cinta Larga realize, okay, to get these things that we want, metal tools, refrigerators, cars, chainsaws, outboard motorboats, all these things that, they now need, they can sell the natural resources from the forest.
Because that's kind of the turning point in the book when they started selling the mahogany. Like, okay, now shit's about to get real. How were diamonds even discovered there? Like, it's easy for us. Oh, diamonds are found there. How is it even randomly discovered in the Amazon? Like, yes, they have the wood, which makes a lot of sense, but how are the diamonds even discovered?
So the Amazon, you got to go, in a way you have to go way back hundreds of years, but the Amazon has always been, in the settler's imagination and in the fortune seeker's imagination, it's always been this place of hidden riches, right? Of El Dorado. So, going back to the earliest days of European colonization, there were always people looking for gold, looking for diamonds, and they would, the best way to get around in the Amazon in the days before highways was traveling by river. So, fortune seekers would, they'd travel by river, and along the way they would pan for diamonds and gold. And so, going back to the 1960s, when the first highway was built through that region, which allowed a lot more people to start coming into this part of the Amazon, which previously had been really difficult to access, they started searching for gold and diamonds in the river and in the rivers. And diamonds started turning up in the rivers of this region, but no one knew what the source was. They'd find diamonds, but never the mother lode. And then in the year 2000, this Surinamese prospector, this guy, an amazing character who went by the nickname Old Luca, because at the time he was 80 years old, and
Unreal.
still looking for diamonds. He was also known as Spotted Luca, Luca Pintado, because he had vitiligo. So he had this, sort of patchy skin. But he approached Piu and said, "Let me onto your people's land because I think I know where the mother lode is of diamonds." And Piu's like, "All right, well, I guess I have nothing to lose. We'll let this guy come in." And the guy goes into the forest, and no, I mean, it's unclear how this guy knew. I actually met the guy when he was 103 years
Oh
old.
shit, okay.
He was still alive in, I guess it was 2019 when I met him. He's since died, but 103 years old. But I interviewed him about this. He claimed, I asked him, how did you know where the
Yeah.
diamonds were? And he claimed to have sort of supernatural
All
powers.
right.
Who knows? He also claimed to have these old maps from this legendary explorer. There's a lot of sort of myth making. It was probably just blind luck,
Yeah.
because there were enough fortune seekers looking. One was going to find it eventually. But he finds the mother lode, and within weeks, basically as soon as they. This guy, this Luca Pintado, old Luca, he proposes to Pew, like, let's dig him up, let's make some money. But as soon as, they bring in some machines, but, to finance their operations, they're going to have to sell a bit of their production. And as soon as they sell a diamond, within weeks, hundreds of prospectors are flocking there from across the region and eventually from across Brazil. And within a very short time, there are 5,000 prospectors in the middle of the rainforest, outnumbering the Cinta Larga themselves. Basically created this boom town in the middle of the rainforest.
Your book goes from the history of these people to the 60s when the white man came, to the 80s when the tribe went down to 400, to the wood, to the diamond, and it all cultivated to, we'll call it the incident, when you mentioned 29 people died and stuff. In the book, that was the main, the crux of the book. Yeah, holy shit, we finally got to this, which was so intense and so graphic and so perfectly written. For them, is it still talked about? You're down there. Is it still for them like a monumental thing? Or is it like, oh yeah, that was, oh, it is. Okay.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, and this, yeah, so yeah, as I said, I framed the book around this massacre in 2004 for a few different reasons. First, because you're always, as a writer, you're always looking for sort of the inherently dramatic
Yeah.
event, right? But I didn't want it to be something cheap either, and as I thought about it, I realized it was also like really germane to their story. Because here's this people who they had suffered massacres themselves in the 1960s. They'd been the poster children of in the 1960s of Brazil's sort of onslaught against indigenous people. And then in the 2000s they become associated with a massacre that some of their people had committed. And in the trial that arose from this, there's this strange jurisprudence in Brazil where, when indigenous people are accused of committing a crime, an anthropologist has to be hired to weigh in on, can this person actually stand trial? Do they understand that it's a crime? Because you can imagine it like a completely isolated indigenous person in the rainforest, if he kills an invader with an arrow, how can you take him to court for that? On the other hand, there are indigenous people who, they've spent a lot of time in Western society and understand, this stuff quite well and understand how laws work and so on. So it became part of the case around this massacre to sort of decide, how assimilated are the Cinta Larga? And I thought it was such a fascinating question because, they themselves don't know. They themselves are wrestling with this. What am I? And they would say this to me: Am I still an Indian? Am I a white person now? What am I? So, it was a chance. It was, it was an inherently dramatic event. It was also a chance to kind of, explore these really fundamental questions. But it is something that is definitely, returning to your question, really, really present for them still. The first time I went in 2017, I remember the teacher at the local school asked me to speak to his class. And one of the girls asked me, were you afraid to come here? Were you afraid that we would kill you and eat you?
What?
So they're really ashamed of this
Oh.
reputation, partly because there's this, and I think this is a really common problem, where, and I think this, I think there's a bit of racism here when outsiders think about, oh, a tribe, like they're all just this sort of monolith,
Yes.
But every, it's a tribe of 2,500 people, and they have 2,500 different opinions and ways of looking at the world. And there were the Diamond Barons, that was a small group. There were the warriors who committed that horrible massacre, again, another small group, but most of them have nothing to do with that stuff. So it's a great source of shame for them, and also concretely, it was something that, and now you also, so you read the book and you don't know this because this happened after the book had already gone to press. But this case had been hanging over their heads for 2 decades. The massacre happened in 2004, and some of the main people in my book, such as Pew, who I've already mentioned, were accused of participating. Pew was accused of orchestrating the massacre, and I tried to show in my book that this was pretty, there was basically no evidence against him. People placed him at the village far from the scene of the massacre on the day in question. The police tried to claim that he was responsible just because he was the chief, you know, which again gets it back to this question of racism and
Every
like,
tribe's the same, yes, right?
right. And like there's some supreme leader who just commands everyone to do like they're robots. So I tried to show that, you know, and this was my belief based on all my reporting that he had been unjustly accused, but you know, he was accused for 20 years of being the orchestrator of a horrific massacre. You know, someone who had been through so many horrible things in his own life, who'd been a victim of such terrible atrocities. You know, so this was hanging over their heads, and they were afraid. On the one hand, they had the bad reputation, but on the other hand, like, you know, are we going to go to prison over this? Now, what happened just in October, September or October? There's a this case, you know, the Brazilian justice system is notoriously slow, surreally slow. So this case has been dragging along this whole time. It's sort of been, it was picked up again recently by a different judge, and there's a different team of prosecutors on it. And in September, October, this new team of prospector, excuse me, was I saying prospectors? Prosecutors. I always mix that one up. This new team of prosecutors asked the judge to throw out the charges against Pew and several other people. Who basically who there was very little evidence for. So and this is something I wish this had happened before, you know, the book had gone to press, because it's so important to kind of bring that, you know, story to a close finally. But you know, the fact remains that they had to, you know, they had to live with this kind of unjust stain on their reputation for 2 decades, basically.
The complicated history of tribes in Brazil. I think it's the largest, but aren't there like over 100 different tribes uncontacted that are still down there that have, I think it's the biggest in the world. I could be wrong. I'm wrong a lot. What is your opinion on that? I bet you it's all over the place. Like, 'cause you know, nothing's better. Listen, you're on Twitter. You see, oh, tribe, you're clicking it right away. That's the first thing you're gonna do. So what are your thoughts on it? And what do the Brazilian people, the mainland people, think about all the tribes in the Amazon? Do they want to just leave them alone? Do they want to get in there? How does that work?
Yeah, no, you're right. They're still, and I forget the number as well. They're still isolated groups in the Amazon. And it's shocking to think, but you know, the Amazon is as large as the contiguous United States. You know, it's a huge area, and a lot of it is still, you know, it doesn't have any highways or anything. How do Brazilians see it? Yeah, I mean, you know, they're sort of, I guess there are two different conflicting views. They're, you know, the kind of more common view on the, like the view of Bolsonaro, for example, the former president, you know, who people called the Trump of the tropics, was, you know, they're people who are they're savages, they're primitives, they have no culture, and they're in the way of developing the Amazon, which is obviously a very problematic view. Now, on the left, on and you see this among, you know, environmental activists and journalists, there's a view that is also really problematic of indigenous people as, and this is not just in Brazil, this is everywhere. You know, this is in the United States as well. There's this view of indigenous people as forest guardians, is the really common phrase you see. And, you know, the idea is that they're these indigenous people living in harmony with nature, and all they want to do is protect their sort of ancestral way of life. And there's some truth to this, and there are indigenous people who embrace this identity. But then there are people like the Cinta Larga who are, you know, they are not that. And some of them would complain to me like, you know, are we not allowed to grow? Are we not allowed to change? You know, are we not allowed to have a cell phone, to have a car? You know, can we not still be indigenous and be Cinta Larga if we have these things that are like, you know, really useful tools? And you know, it's a very different and more subtle form of racism, you know, that where you reduce them to symbols, basically. You know, you consign them to this timeless past where they're frozen in time, right? And in a way, you know, it sort of it plays into the hands of the people on the other side who, you know, who see them as primitives, you know, and it's sort of the other side of the coin. And the Cinta Larga, you know, what a lot of them would tell me is, you know, we want to take the best of both worlds. You know, we want to find a way to live, you know, in the present. We want to send our kids to university. We want to maintain some of our traditions, but you know, we want to live in the, you know, in the present.
When books hit and they go big, or when a show goes big, like White Lotus, everyone then goes to wherever it is. Do you think people, and can they even go down there? People are going to read this. Like, I'm a huge traveler. Seriously, Alex, my goal is to visit every country in the world. All I try to do is travel, okay? I read this, I'm like, bro, I would love to get down there. Is it even, not me, I'm not going to go, don't worry. But is it even possible, like, oh yeah, I'm going to go down there and see them? Because, like, it's interesting as hell, man. Do you think that can even happen? How does that, do people try to do that?
That's a good question. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that, to be honest. If you want to go, let me know and I'll give you someone's contact information. They don't speak English, unfortunately. It's a pretty hard place to go as a tourist. There's really no tourist. I mean, if we're talking about specifically where the Cinta Larga live, there's a neighboring tribe called the Surui. And they do a little more tourism. They're sort of they've been a little more savvy about you know, doing the whole eco-tourism thing. I think they do the ayahuasca ceremonies and stuff, even though that is not at all traditional for them. You know, it's a they saw it as a you know a good business
Hell
opportunity.
yeah.
It would not be an easy place to go. But yeah, I know they would like to. That I mean, you know, the Cinta Larga, you know, I mentioned they want a sustainable way to make a living. And they would say to me, you know, we don't like partnering with loggers, partnering with criminals, you know, diamond prospectors and whatnot. They would like to have a sustainable, you know, way to make a living. They'd love to do ecotourism, but it's so hard to do. There's just very little infrastructure. You know, they don't speak English. But I mean, it's worth a visit. It's really, you know, it's an incredible place. It's a beautiful place. You know, the Amazon. It's amazing. It's, you know, as much as it's been deforested and, you know, changed by human activity, there are spots where, you know, you get a view of like, you know, a sea of forest. You know, you fly over and, you know, it's just it looks like an endless sea of forest, and to walk, you know, to walk around in that forest, it's really, you know, it's a really special experience. You know, it's one of these places that, you know, you think, man, is this gonna exist in a generation? Yeah.
You touched on it at the end of the book, and I have a lot of either athletes or authors on. Those are my two favorite things, sports and reading, and of course, traveling. When I finish your book, I always want to keep it up, so I'll keep Googling the book. You know, I read mostly nonfiction. Do you feel like an attachment of the relationships you cultivated? Like, do you still keep in touch with these people? Like, because you just invested years of your life in writing a book about them. So for me, it's like, holy shit, like, you came on the show. I'm going to be annoying as hell. I'm like, oh, randomly text you about something from San Francisco if I'm having a good bagel. Do you still keep in touch? Because you invested a chunk of your life to these people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, 7 years
Oof.
that I've been working on this, and you know, some of these people, the people who I spent the most time with, They are, they became friends along the way. And it's, as a journalist, it's all, it becomes very complicated, because they're my friends, but they're also sources, they're subjects. And, I tried to not let my friendship with them, for example, with Pio, he's someone I came to really admire, and like, and I tried not to let that cloud my, my judgment of the story, and to tell things, and to tell things straight. But it's all mixed up, and you just have to kind of live with that. But I actually went there in November to present my book to them with my wife, who'd never been there before, and she'd heard the stories about them and also wanted to meet them. And it was a really amazing event. I wanted to go show my face because I'd heard them complain about other people who'd come and, an anthropologist or something who, they get what they need and then they never come back. They never sort of show the result of their work. So I wanted to show the result of my work. And then I also kind of, I wanted to shape their impression of it a bit because I thought, they're going to end up hearing about it. You probably saw there was a New York Post,
Yeah, that's how I heard about the book.
Right. I figured because you emailed me that day that it came
Yes.
out. So I was a little worried, how are they going to end up hearing about this? And, I want to tell them about it myself. So I obviously none of them read English, but I brought an AI translated printout
Oh,
so
shit.
that, if
Okay.
someone wants to, they can read for themselves and know for themselves what's in it. And I gave them a hard drive with all the documents that I'd obtained as part of my research, so that if some Cinta Larga historian one day wants to use this stuff, he can. But it was really great. It was a really meaningful event. They gave me arrows, which is a really sort of symbolic traditional honor. And it was really great. But no, this whole time, even when I'm not reporting, we keep in touch by WhatsApp.
So cool.
They'll send me audio messages. Some of them never learn to read and write, but they send audio messages. And I continue to get messages, and people check in on New Year's, that sort of thing. And I'm sure that I'll continue to keep in touch with them. It's like people you meet who, 7 years, like we really, it's a real friendship. So yeah, I hope to continue these. To maintain that over the years for sure.
Ready to finish up with some quick hit questions.
All right, let's do
What book are you currently reading?
it. Okay, this is, well, I don't know if this is embarrassing, but so my wife's about to have a kid, our first kid.
Wow,
So
congratulations.
thank you. So I'm reading Bringing Up Bebe,
Okay.
Which is this book about how the French do parenting.
Okay, how about before that? What other?
Oh, what was the book I was reading before that? Hold on, I have to look at my list.
All right.
My brain is so scrambled from before that. I read this incredible book by Nathan Thrall, A Day in the Life by Abed Salama. Which is this narrative nonfiction immersion into the lives of these Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank, and just a really, really beautiful book, really well put together. Yeah, incredible book. It won the Pulitzer last year.
Oh, wow, that's actually a good one. How about this? Coolest person in your phone. You and I are in New York City. You have the book, but it's a bar in the city. Like, who cares? Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back? So a little name dropping right now.
If they texted me, or if I texted them, they would text me back. I mean, I guess it would be a writer.
Yeah, give me a cool writer
Don't
then.
know. Probably John Lee Anderson.
Okay, that's a good answer.
He's
That's a good answer.
yeah, he's he was friends with my godfather, and yeah, he's yeah, become close to him over the years. Yeah, he he blurbed both of my books, and he's a really great reporter and great writer, and also just a great guy.
Last show you binge watched.
What was it? I guess it was like I binge watched two recently. But the one I really binge was the adaptation of Say Nothing
Oh,
by
I just
Patrick
downloaded
Rodney
that.
Heath.
I'm going away in 2 weeks. Patrick was on the show and it came out. So I'm going away in 2 weeks. I just downloaded that on Hulu. So that's gonna be for my flights. That's actually what I'm gonna watch.
It's really well done, I think, and I guess he was quite involved in it from listening to an interview with him. Really well done. It's rare that you get TV that good, and yeah, I felt like it did the book justice. Really good.
And you said there was two. What was the other one you binged?
100 Years of Solitude, the Netflix adaptation, was also really well done. A book I read as a teenager and loved. Obviously an icon. You can't mess that up. If you
No.
mess that up, you've committed a crime against literature. But they really did it well. You really got a great sense of the place. It was all Colombian actors with the right accents. It was really good.
Last two. 2 a.m. You get home. What food are you craving? And not bagel. 2 a.m. You're in San Fran. You get home. What food are you craving at 2 a.m. just watching something?
Oh, if it's in San Francisco at 2 a.m., definitely a burrito.
Okay. How about anywhere else? New
Yeah,
York, you have
great,
any bagel?
huge burritos out here. Yeah, I mean, at 2 a.m. in New York, like I don't do this. I'm never up at 2 a.m.
No, me
anymore.
either. I'm an
But
old man now, so.
when I was a young man in New York, 2 a.m. was pizza, obviously.
Of course, pizza or a
Yeah.
gyro. I can always do a gyro at like 2 a.m., you know?
Oh, I was a pizza man.
And last
Pepperoni
one,
pizza.
in your life, traveling the world, coolest person you've ever taken a picture with?
Coolest person I've ever taken a picture with. Okay, so this is some. I mean, this is just what pops into my head, because I can't think of any celebrities or anyone that you might have heard of. I went to Northern Iraq to do a story once in the mountains of Sinjar, to do a story about the Yazidis, who are this religious minority. And I met these elders, these guys with just these massive white beards, that come halfway down their chest. And at the time, I had it in my head that to fit in better with all the, bearded Middle Eastern people, I was going to try to grow my beard, but all I can really do is kind of a patchy goatee. So I have a picture of myself with this pathetic goatee next to this guy with the most impressive gray beard in the mountains of Sinjar, literally up on this ridge. And it was at that point that I realized I should never attempt to grow a beard again. But that's probably the coolest guy.
That's actually a great answer. The book, When We Sold God's Eye, Diamonds, Murder, and a Clash of Worlds in the Amazon. Alex, this was a blast. Just plug the Twitter, the site, not that you need it, but plug wherever I can get the book and read your good stuff and your reporting and your articles and stuff.
Right. Yes. My website is alexquadros.com. That's Quadros, and that has a link to my books and articles and so on. So that's a place to go. Twitter, I am there, but less and less.
Yes. Aren't we all? Dude, this was such a blast. Congratulations on becoming a father. Super
Thank you,
cool. And dude,
my other baby.
this was so much fun, man. Thank you for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. I really loved your book. It was one of my favorite books I read last year.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that, and I really enjoyed this.
Well, keep in touch, right, brother?
Great. Thank you.
Be
Will
good, my
do.
friends.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good
Bye-bye.
one.